Welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast series sponsored by the Amerikazentrum Hamburg. I'm your host, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and teacher. In each episode of this series, my guests and I will discuss a work of literature set primarily in Chicago. For this episode, it's a little bit different. We'll be discussing the life and work of Studs Terkel, and my guests are Mark Larson and Peter T. Alter. Mark Larson is the author of Ensemble, an Oral History of Chicago Theater, for which he conducted over 300 interviews with Chicago theater artists, past and present. His new book, Working in the 21st Century, an Oral History of American Work in a Time of Social and Economic Transformation, was inspired by and has been released to coincide with the 50th anniversary of Studs Terkel, our subject today, Working. Esquire magazine recently named this book as one of the best books of 2024 so far. Larson is currently working on Ed Asner, a composite portrait. He holds a doctorate in educational leadership. Peter T. Alter is the Chicago History Museum's Gary T. Johnson Chief Historian and Director of the Studs Terkel Center for Oral History. The Oral History Center develops collaborative, community-based oral history projects using tools of history and oral history for goals of social justice. Alter also teaches in the DePaul University's Public History Program. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
So today we're going to discuss the life and wide-ranging work of Studs Terkel, and especially Working, which, as I just mentioned in the introduction to Mark, was published in 1974. It's the 50th anniversary of it. A lot of our listeners, particularly those based in Germany, might not be as aware of who Studs Terkel is. I think anyone who grew up in Chicago from roughly the 1950s through the 1990s knows who Studs Terkel is because he's part of our culture. Studs Terkel was on the radio on a weekly basis. His books were everywhere. He's a very well-known part of our cultural fabric. To people outside of Chicago or outside the United States, certainly, he might be a little bit less known. So I wonder, Mark, if you could start by just filling us in a little bit on who this man is.
Sure. He is. You're absolutely right. He was an extraordinary figure. And, you know, I'm very skewed because I'm very tuned into him and he's very important to me. So I don't know what people know, but he was many things. He was an oral historian, and that's kind of what he's most known for. You mentioned that he was on the radio. He was on the radio five mornings a week for about 45 years, conducting it. Just multiple interviews over that time. He was also an actor too. He started off as a radio actor playing pretty much the bad guy. He had this kind of husky voice and manner. He was in a movie called Eight Men Out too. He played a sportscaster. So he did that. He's also very much of a kind of less leftist progressive activist in a lot of ways. So he's involved in politics in many ways too. But I think what we're here to talk about mainly is him as an oral historian, because he has something like 17 books of oral histories, which is kind of astonishing too, because he didn't write Division Street, his first oral history book, till he was 55 years old, something like that, which is also extraordinary. But his oral histories, I think, have played a huge role in our understanding of oral history in modern times too, partly because he was so good at it, and partly because his body of work was so vast and so varied that it's quite extraordinary. When you look at, he's talking to people like Martin Luther King, Louis Armstrong, he's talking to Mahalia Jackson, Woody Allen. The range of celebrities is extraordinary in itself, but also the incredible body of work speaking to what he called the uncelebrated, which is kind of where his heart was, is how I read him.
Yeah. Could you say what he means by the uncelebrated?
People who are not celebrities, people who are not often acknowledged for the work that they do or the person they are.
What we used to call working stiffs.
Working stiffs, yeah. Or just, you know, somebody who's not even working.
Yeah.
It's just...
just people.
You know, I even heard a recording of a interview he did with his taxi driver on his way to O'Hare Airport. Not for a book, not for a radio broadcast. It's just he wanted to talk to this person, you know?
Peter, who's Studs Terkel to you? That, not that Mark's left much out, but...
Yeah, and of course, Mark has a long personal relationship with Studs as well. So I've worked at the Chicago History Museum since 1999. And when I got there, Studs was a scholar in residence and was a scholar in residence at the Chicago History Museum from the mid-1990s for about 7-8 years from that point. So I knew Studs. I knew Studs before, but only as an avid reader, especially of The Good War, which, of course, won him the Pulitzer Prize. You know, I was always attracted to history. And as Mark quoted, Studs, the uncelebrated or voices that we're not often used to hearing. And so The Good War does a lot of that. And so that was really the Studs book that I grew up on. Came to Chicago History Museum midway through 1999 and just, wow, there's Studs Terkel walking around Chicago History Museum, which was pretty amazing. One of my famous brushes with him, famous to me, is that I helped him once send a FedEx package because his normal person who did that was not in the office. And he was so happy that his package was going out that he signed my copy of The Good War.
That's fabulous.
Yeah. So what he is to the institution of the Chicago History Museum, when he came to us, he donated several thousand, not the entire catalog, because those are still surfacing, but nearly the entire catalog of those radio tapes from WFMT radio. He also had previously donated his paper office files, going back to when people actually had kept paper and manila folders with the little tabs. And then about the time that he left, he also donated his working, not the book working, but his files for most of his books. So we have a fabulous treasure trove of his transcripts, for example. So you can look at the published work and compare those to the transcripts. And it's a pretty amazing kind of sleuthing of a historian, of a literary person, and just how he introduced and constructed each and every interview, at least insofar as we have them represented in the transcripts.
That's amazing.
It is, yeah. And of course, I'm sure we'll mention it multiple times, but there is the Studs Terkel Radio Archive that is available online, known here, at least in the Chicagoland area, by STRAW, the Studs Terkel Radio Archive, which is maintained by the radio station WFMT. The Library of Congress was generous enough to digitize all of his book and radio tapes. WFMT was generous enough to manage the servicing of them. And then we at the Chicago History Museum keep the physical, mostly reel-to-reel and audio cassette tapes in our archives at our location at 1601 North Clark Street in Chicago.
What a treasure trove.
Yeah, it has to be said that online archive is amazing. And anyone can go and look at it for free and mess around with it. And you can listen to radio broadcasts like as... you know, as essentially as they were broadcast. Sometimes there's songs missing when there's musicians and stuff or readings from books are sometimes missing because of copyright stuff. But like you can hear a whole radio show and you can also edit them and save out audio clips for yourself. And it's an amazing educational tool for people who are listening to this podcast and might want to use some of that stuff. Like there's the resource is incredible because it's not just, you know, I'm going to just kind of bring a couple things together here from what both of you said. It's like, you know, Studs Terkel interviewed the Mahalia Jacksons and Bob Dylans and Louis Armstrongs and these famous people, but he interviewed just regular people. And the radio show does that. The books do that. And you can listen to this stuff. And, you know, you hear him walking around, you know, with social workers on the west side of Chicago, just interviewing teenage kids in the 60s about their what they think about themselves and their lives. And it's just incredible to, like, you can just access this these documents and listen to them yourself for your own entertainment or your own education or whatever. If you're reading a book by one of the other Chicago authors in this podcast series, there's probably interviews, multiple interviews with them in that archive, and they're incredible. I want to turn to, because I'm also interested in what you said, something, Peter, about you've got all these like transcripts and the audio files from the interviews that went into the books. And that's maybe a nice way to think about, to start thinking about Working, which I guess it's fair to say is Studs Terkel's most famous book. It was a massive bestseller when it came out. And so he's like, that's for me, that's my introduction to Studs Terkel, was my parents' bookshelves. I remember just seeing that book when I was a little kid. And like, first of all, it's a huge, fat book. It's got so many pages, especially when you're a little kid. It's called Working, which is something that's so alien to you when you're like 6 or 7 years old. What is Working? And it's got this amazing name on the front, Studs Terkel. This sounds like someone you want to know, you know. But these books are incredible because they present themselves. The shape of them is interesting. They're just people talking about themselves, about their work and their lives. Yeah. Occasionally an interjection from Studs Terkel where he's asked a question, but only occasionally. You don't often see the questions that he's asking. And it just, so you end up just reading these, what almost look like monologues, short monologues by people. They're never very particularly long, and they're always really fascinating. But of course, these are things are constructed. And like when I used to teach Studs Terkel on one of my literature courses, I'd ask my students about, like, what's authorship mean in this book? Because there's this highly intelligent man, Studs Terkel, not only asking the questions, interviewing the people, but then shaping this into a thing that looks as though he's had nothing to do with it, even though he's had everything to do with it. And there's a real genius in that. I wonder whether, Mark, you want to talk, because your own book builds on this way of Working and addresses the same subject. And I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about Studs Terkel as, you know, an author and as a researcher and as a interviewer and what this means, not only for Studs, but also if you could talk a bit about your own work and how Studs has influenced that, would be really helpful.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned that he almost evaporates, you know, and he did that very intentionally, but I know that he bristled at the notion that, you know, some people like to say he's just taking recorded conversations and putting them in a book, which gives him no credit for shaping it, for the questions that he asked and then later pulled out. But he worked very hard to shape those chapters as they are, while retaining the person's speaking voice, too. To make it, I think he said somewhere, he starts with 60 pages of transcript, and he goes down to 6 pages. You know, there's a real skill to it. He used an interesting combination of words. He says it's partly skill, and it's partly respect. So the respect for the speaker, you know. Adjacent to that, I was interviewed by him twice myself. I sat on his couch with him for 3.5 hours or so each time. And I was very surprised, having followed his work for a long time, he asked me very few questions in that time. Yes, he pulled a lot of his questions out, but at least in my 2 experiences, he didn't ask a whole lot, but they sure were leading questions. They sure took you where you wanted, where he wanted you to go. He didn't want you to go. He wanted to explore with you, which is very different, you know? So I find that aspect of his work really fascinating. Sidney Lewis, who was his transcriptionist for a long time and then worked on both of his memoirs with him and was a very close friend, used the analogy of a Rubik's Cube. She said he just kept playing with it and playing with it until he got it to work, the chapter. So I don't know if I answered your question. I felt like I went on a tangent there.
No, I think that certainly gets us down the road to an answer. Yeah, because I mean, that's the kind of thing I'm interested in, is like these working practices and one of the things you said about the way he respects, he respects the voice of the person that he's talking to is a really difficult ability to develop, I think, for any person. It's one of the things that I think makes his work so great is that he very clearly just respects people in an upfront way. He respects that they're a person who has something to say, and the rest of the kind of whatever judgments he might want to make. He's not an unjudgmental person, because no person is unjudgmental, but you don't see that judgment happening on the page of his books. And so that any single person saying whatever they're saying is given the benefit of their voice, which is, I think, the real, and the fact that these are real people getting the benefit of their voice on the page, and that it's not just a person speaking. It's not just a person speaking on his couch, in your case, for example. It's a person who's spoken on his couch, who's now had what they've said been given that sort of dignity and shape and a kind of literary quality to it. I don't want to overstate that part of it necessarily, but like it's a document and it's a literary form at the same time, and it gives that, elevates that kind of artifice. I don't mean that in a pejorative way, like the artifice turns their an average, the uncelebrated person's ideas and thoughts into art and into something more dignified than just, you know, blathering at the bar or whatever it is, or shows what dignity exists in that moment of speaking about yourself for people that aren't going to go to the bar to listen to this person speak, or aren't going to go to the auto factory to talk to the auto worker, or go to the hospital to find the guy sweeping the floors or whatever. It's a really interesting aspect of his work, which I think also starts to speak to why he's so important in Chicago. Peter, I don't know if you want to come in on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think your original kind of framing, Doug, about sort of, and Mark's, that he's not just, he didn't just set up the recorder and kind of walk away and then just transcribe that and slap that into a book. I think, again, referring to the paper archive at Chicago History Museum, you know, you see like how he's crafting everything through the transcripts.
Yes, yeah.
And he did. I noticed in some situations where he'll maybe take a sentence from minute 13 of the interview and it will end up with four paragraphs from minutes 56 of the interview. So that analogy of the Rubik's Cube is very appropriate. And just the way he would frame the interviews, I always talk about interview that he conducted again for the Good War of this locally well-known civil rights leader and business leader, Earl B. Dickerson. And they were friends. And he said, you know, and he interviewed Earl Dickerson for his book, Hard Times, which was about the Great Depression. So he's interviewing him about Mr. Dickerson's experiences during World War II, and especially around the founding of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And, you know, he says, this is a lot like my book about the Depression, Hard Times. You know, we're talking about what it's like to be alive during this specific time period. And so not really directing him in a specific way, but just laying out, okay, World War II, what was it like for you? These simple, straightforward questions that would elicit some very profound answers.
That's a great way to put it. He used to use the phrase, I just want to know what it's like to be you, mm-hmm. you know, and then, as you said, in that context, you know, of the good quotes in quotes, the good war,
right.
In the Depression, what's it like to be you? And he was deeply curious about that, too.
I think that deep curiosity is the thing that comes through in a really interesting way when you read these books. Again, for people who are listening who haven't read his books, you basically just get person speaking. Sometimes he tells you where he talked to them. Sometimes you might get a question that interjects just as a way of bridging what's one thing that someone's saying to something else or whatever. But you just get them speaking, but you constantly have this sense of the author who wrote the book and that author's curiosity driving this. And it's such an open-hearted curiosity, I think, is that question, like, I want to know what it's like to be you in this moment, is like, you can feel that, and you can feel people respond to that, because it seems one of his real abilities was, and maybe this is where a bit of his biography helps out, you know, his, so he was a son of Russian Jewish immigrants to the United States. Unforgivably for a Chicago icon, he was born in New York. It's like I was thinking about this.
He wasn't there long.
No, thank God. Yeah, he moved as a small child to Chicago. I was thinking about this earlier today. And I was thinking like the two unforgivable things for Chicagoans are to like to be born in New York or to like be from the suburbs and not actually from the city. His parents ran a hotel or boarding house for a long time, and he grew up in this boarding house, right? And listened to people. And I think that, you know, from a young age, listening to people and then growing into an adult who maintained that kind of childlike curiosity and hearing what other people are saying and marrying that to an intellect and a maturity is really an extraordinary talent and ability that Studs Terkel cultivated in himself. And it drives these books. It's evident in the introductions that he wrote later for these books. Like you see him looking at the stuff he's done and synthesizing what these people are saying with like economics, political history, American history, literature, songs, like all this stuff comes together and you start to see why that or how that curiosity and how that drive works. He's not just listening to people talking. He's listening to the books he's reading. He's listening to the music he's listening to and constantly synthesizing these things. I was rereading all the introductions to the books I have in the last couple of days just as a way of preparing for this recording. And it was just amazing to see that sentence by sentence, this guy is just always pulling stuff together in really meaningful ways that really speak to, like, so, you know, some of these things were written in the introductions, I mean, were written in the 80s and in the 90s. And they resonate really strongly to today. I wonder, I just inadvertently gave myself a segue, Mark, to ask you a little bit about your own book that is kind of, if I don't mischaracterize it, is almost like it's taking the same kind of method of working 50 years later and saying, because one of the things that's interesting about working is, you know, the work in the 70s is very different to work in the 2020s.
Quite.
And you're kind of taking that and saying, not updating the book, but rather applying the same methods to the present day to see what happens. Is that right?
Yeah. One of my intentions was to, as partly as an homage to him, to 50 years later, is even to use the same kind of format. So it would feel like kind of an echo, but might hopefully accentuate the difference too, because you're looking at the same kind of format if you read them side by side, for example. So it just on that pragmatic fundamental level, I was trying to do that. But I also was trying to play with his idea of what's it like to be you doing this work in these times. Because that's what when I read Working, which he wrote between 70 and 74, you know, the Vietnam War, Watergate, you know, assassinations. That's what the stuff that, you know, the beginnings of women's rights, civil rights, all that was happening in the background. And then even though there aren't a whole lot of direct references to it in his book, you certainly get a sense of how it's impacting people's work and in their lives. And I found that fascinating. And that's what I wanted to do too. So in my book, this again is another parallel. I just want to know what it's like to be you doing this work in these times. You know, so there's not a whole lot of references. I don't ask them, what do you think of Donald Trump? That's not my purpose. But you sure can see the impact of what's going on culturally here on a teacher, for example, someone who performs abortions, and she's preparing in Illinois for women coming across the border because of, you know, our surrounding states won't allow it. So that's how the politics comes out there. But I meant that to be a parallel to Studs's book too.
Yeah. It's interesting you say you didn't ask them these direct political questions, because he doesn't really seem to do that either, except in Division Street America, which is just as good as Working, really, really interesting. It's got a different kind of compression because it's all interviews with people, I guess I can't remember exact years. Is it 67, 68, something like that?
Yeah.
all people living in different parts of Chicago. So it's using Chicago as a kind of microcosm for America in a way. And he makes the note of the, in the introduction, that Division Street is a real street in Chicago, but it's not, this isn't about that street.
It's also a metaphor.
That's Nelson Algren covered yeah. that for everybody else. It's a metaphor, but it's it's a really, really interesting book. Cause it feels a bit more condensed or dense than Working. And he did specifically ask one question, the same question of everybody in that book. And he says in the introduction, it wouldn't have come up otherwise, but he asked them how they felt about the bomb. And it's always really interesting in that book how when that question comes to people, it always is like a completely different narrative to what, you know, when yeah. they suddenly address this thing, oh, I don't think about the bomb that much, or I think about, you know, nuclear bombs all the time or whatever. But it's always there's this abrupt shift in their tone or whatever. But they've also, as you've just kind of said, they've implicitly been talking with that as part of the background noise, along with the Vietnam War and everything else, of the civil rights is a big major issue in Division Street America. But that, like, the background noise is there, but they just haven't addressed it directly. So to see that rupture where then they do address it directly is a really interesting thing. I don't sure know what I wanted to say with that, other than that I think it's interesting.
Well, that's an interesting observation. It really is. And I was just sort of, I'm surmising. I have no idea if this is true. But in the process of putting that together, and it's his first book, his first oral history book. And so he's learning how to do it. You know, I'm wondering if partway through it, he recognized, wow, when I ask that question, I get quite a shift.
Yeah.
And that's so, as opposed to when he started off saying, you know what, I'm always going to ask about the bomb, you know?
Yeah.
I just have a feeling that came out and he thought, I got to keep focusing on that.
Yeah. It becomes a question of like,
yeah.
Yeah, it gets him someplace. That's a slight contradiction to what we were talking about earlier, right? Where it's like he doesn't want you to go in a particular place. Here is a question where he shows how good the other stuff is as well. Yeah. Like, not that that question is bad, but like by saying this is where I want you to go, I want you to address this thing, yeah. and it's a different motive. Suddenly, people respond and answer questions in different ways.
Well, he said he deliberately never wrote down questions because he didn't want them to sound like questions. He wanted it to be a conversation. And I love his notion that it was an exploration. Let's explore area that neither you nor I have explored. You know, so he's taking people places that they hadn't been.
Yeah, but he's going there with them.
And he's going there with them and helping them get there too. You know,
that strikes me
as... I'm sorry.
That strikes me as an interesting touching point with his radio interviews as well. I don't know whether you're going to agree with me on this, Peter, that I presume he prepared questions for some of those radio interviews. You know, you're interviewing an author, you're prepare some questions about their books. At the same time, when like one of the joys of listening to him on the radio, and I've listened to lots of his musician and author interviews in particular, because those are areas of my professional interest and general interest, but like, is that he's always having a conversation and going on that kind of journey with them and those things too, and rather than just, and you know, where did you write the book or what's that song about? It's never it's never that kind of interview. It's a real discursive, this is a thing that's interesting. Oh, you know, and you can hear, sometimes you hear him like this, like flipping through the pages of the book, and it's really, it seems that there's a touching point. They're different media, but the radio, I forgot what the word I was going to use. His approach to radio seems similar in that respect. I don't, Peter, do you want to speak to that at all?
Sure. Yeah. And I think your point, Doug, about sort of his preparation, absolutely. Whether he on the radio had written questions, probably not. But one of the other things that we have in our collections is the books written by authors who are on the episodes of his show. And the example that I often give is this historian who wrote kind of the biography of Eugene V. Debs, a famous American socialist. And the author and a historian was on Studs' show. And the author said afterwards to a friend of mine who was a student of this historian, you know, Studs knew my book as well as anyone, probably better than me. And you look at the books that are in the Chicago History Museum's collections, and there's, you know, on many of them, notations like everywhere, in some cases, as many words as are in the book are in his marginalia. And so he was, you know, definitely preparing. Another thing, you know, we've been talking about various musicians. He had a vast record library. Now he couldn't write notes on the vinyl, but, you know, clearly if he had musicians on his show, he was listening to them ahead of time. And of course, you know, interspersing their music, you know, in between his questions and the conversation. And so, yes, there was an enormous amount of preparation. And for his books, it seems like every previous interview was preparation for that interview in that moment. So he wanted to present like this. People would often talk about how he fumbled with the recording machine, you know, but a lot of times that was like, okay, he doesn't know what he's doing. He knew what he was doing enough to get the recording, but he's also making people feel a little comfortable in that moment when they don't know what this person whom they've never met is going to ask them about, like in their living room, right? So yeah, just an amazing amount of preparation, whether we could see it or knew about it or not.
He actually did that with me, fumbled with the recorder. And it wasn't until later that I read that he does it all the time.
Right.
So it works.
We started the... It still worked.
He suckered you. Mm-hmm.
Can I say something about radio? I bought into it. I helped him with the thing. He says, God damn it, I don't trust these things. And he stopped the interview and it did the whole thing. And then later I read he always does that. I want to say something about radio.
Go for it.
Because I had the privilege of being in the WFMT studio with him for an hour-long live broadcast. And I got to see that work. He was on with a guy that I had been working for at the time. His name is Bert Hillstrom. He created a television show called Kukulcan and Ali, which is part of that Chicago school of television that Studs was part of. So these old buddies together. And it was a round table, there's a microphone kind of hovering over them. And as we were waiting to go on the air, this is live, obviously, they kept going, you know what, why don't we start with a blah, blah, blah. Let's start with this. And then, and then he goes, no, let's not talk about it anymore. And then they'd sort of pace around and they go, you know what would be cool? You know what would be interesting is we did this. No, let's not talk about it. So they were tempted, you know, but they also wanted to be extremely spontaneous. And then secondly, in relation to that, you talked about synthesis very well, I thought. In which he does in his introductions, but on his radio broadcast, and Peter knows this, he synthesizes in real time.
Yeah,
you know, he'll think of a song. He's listening to the person. He sees a theme coming up, and he can pass a note to his audio person to find this record and bring it in it right. So he's making this in real time, which I thought was incredible to witness.
There's just as you say that off the top of my head, there's a great interview that he does with Harry Belafonte in the 50s. It's like it's when Belafonte's first or second record comes out. I can't remember which, but it's a really, really good interview with Harry Belafonte, and he's doing exactly that. You can just hear him. He's thought a lot about it. He's listened to this record. He's thought about it, and he's just pulling stuff together. And you just hear that, like, you know, some of it is not spontaneous, but he's making it sound that way. Some of it is probably spontaneous, and you get these two guys who are both really deep thinkers and careful listeners in different kinds of ways talking to each other. And it's like, it's really one of my favorite things in that whole archive that people can go listen
to. Students could study just that one.
Yeah. It's amazing.
One of my favorite recordings, and I'm sure there's thousands of people, it's also their favorite recording, is he was interviewing Martin Luther King Jr. in 1964. I think it was, he'd been awarded the Peace Prize, Nobel Peace Prize, but hadn't given the speech and actually received it yet in in Europe. And of course, we know he was, Studs was close friends with Mahalia Jackson. Mahalia Jackson was friends with Martin Luther King Jr. and a supporter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, of course, his organization. So that particular day, Mahalia Jackson wasn't feeling very well. So she's kind of convalescing in her bedroom, sitting up in her bed. Studs is sitting at the foot of the bed. And then in a chair next to Mahalia Jackson's bed is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And, you know, clearly Studs had prepared, but, you know, sitting on the edge of someone's bed, and I imagine probably the recorder was maybe on the bed as well, or maybe on a side table, you know, and like these two titanic, you know, luminaries in music, in social justice, civil rights, racial justice, and so forth. It's just, oh, I'm sitting here on the bed, you know, interviewing these two. And it's not a terribly long interview. It's like 17 minutes, but wow, you know,
what
you
a just get,
yeah, you just get so much. And of course, there's a lot of conversation a year before had been the March on Washington. And of course, the epic I Have a Dream speech. So, yeah. And again, your listeners can listen to that online in the Studs Terkel Radio Archive.
There's a similar kind of thing in the one he does with Lorraine Hansberry, where he's at her like mom's apartment in New York City or something, and she keeps bringing cups of tea or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but so every so often he says, "Oh, thank you," you know, and you hear the teacups rattling and stuff, and it's just really like. It says a lot, I think. First of all, it's charming and it's good theater, right? You mentioned earlier, Mark, like he was an actor and doing these things. Like, there's a bit of the showman there, but also, like, it also just gives you this sense of, like, I mean, that's Lorraine Hansberry, right? Like, a major playwright, and he's in her mother's house, and it's like that's the same kind of way that he might be in one of the uncelebrateds, as we were talking earlier, his house, talking to them, and it's just this
good.
Everybody's at the same level of a human being he's in their room with them to listen to them. It's really, really extraordinary. Or ordinary. He's extraordinary at all.
I can't think of any example, I'm sure there might be, but of him being starstruck even.
Nah.
You know, it's just not part of his nature.
Yeah. While at the same time always gives these people like the respect of that they've earned when he's talking to writers, he'll always talk about what a terrific writer he thinks they are, but it's not brown nosing, and it's not unearned. Like, you know, it's based on all those marginalia notes that you were talking about, Peter, you know, it's, he's decided that that's what he thinks about them. That's why they're on the show. And he's just giving them their due.
Peter, do you know how much say he had over who he would interview, especially as an author or an entertainer? Because what I'm thinking is, I don't know that he would have interviewed, just no offense to him, but Henry Winkler's new memoir. You know, would that have captured his attention? You know how now that people have to do these celebrity interviews
right
on their shows. And it just,
yeah, I mean, I would say just based on the papers and the recordings that I've heard, it seems like he had a lot of say in who he would interview. And I mean, he had so many personal relationships with
the
folks whom he interviewed, right? So, you know, almost everyone we've mentioned so far, I think Studs would consider them his friend, and you know, and vice versa, that they were friends. Maybe not someone as well known as Martin Luther King Jr., but certainly they're very friendly in the interview. And Mahalia Jackson was his close friend. You know, Nelson Algren, who we've talked about already. Many of those authors, you know, were definitely friends. So, you know, and the historians maybe who didn't know him, for example, who were on his show. You know, the Eugene V. Debs example, that was an interest of Studs, right? So he wanted to do things, I think rightfully so, that interested him. And you know, that's how you got those great radio programs that people of a certain age from the for over the last 45 years, you know, like, oh, Studs, I remember listening to him, you know, as you were saying, Doug, my dad would work in the garage and there was the show, you know, every day.
Yeah. There's an interesting, like, intersection of stuff happening there where it's like, so if you go back to the example of, well, now someone interviewing, you know, if someone on a talk show is interviewing someone, usually it's because the producers have brought this guy or this person in.
Right.
Like, here's the book, and the researcher reads the book and writes up some notes for them. And they might not have even have read the book themselves, but Studs is his own researcher in that respect. He's reading the book and writing the marginalia himself, and he's deciding what he thinks about it before he goes in himself, rather than some hybrid version of that. But he's also calling on friends to come in, interests that intersect with his own, to bring those people in. So there's this kind of almost like impresario role that he's playing to use his like, I've got this platform of the radio being broadcast to however many million people, and I can showcase this stuff to all those people. And there's, in a really genuine and nice way, and all this stuff is being showcased in the same way through the same conversational mode.
You know, what we might be surfacing is something that I'd never thought about, but I bet this is a luxury that most broadcasters don't have today, except in rare circumstances. I love the impresario.
It just occurred to me while you were talking about it. Like, that's the kind of role, right? Like, I'm interested in Eugene Debs. I've read this history book. I'm Studs Terkel, and I can get this guy on the radio. You know, that's really exciting to be able in that position. Yeah, I mean, nonprofit radio. I suppose if you're like, you know, if you're on some nonprofit radio or internet radio, you could do that kind of thing. But you're not going to reach the like daily broadcast in 1972, you know, Chicago, where people have the radio on all day and you know, are tuning into this, regardless of what it is. You know, it's just, I'm going to listen to Studs Terkel, half listen to what he's talking about so I can get to the records or whatever. You know, it's an amazing medium.
What a boon for those lesser known authors, you know, who are just as worthy, you know, like, I'm sure this historian of the Debs biography that I keep going back to, I mean, that was a great boon. You know, I read it as a graduate student, you know, getting my advanced degrees, but, you know, like, now Studs is lifting this book up, and, you know, and it also had a lot of historical connections to Chicago and so forth. So, I think maybe something that we just haven't seen as much in the last few decades.
I think he opens his interview with James Baldwin, one of his interviews, by saying, I have with me a new young Negro writer.
Yeah.
Named Jimmy Baldwin.
Yeah.
You know, and he had just come back from Paris.
Yeah. Yeah. And you listen to that now. I've listened to that interview and you listen to that now and you're like, my God, this is James. This is the James Baldwin.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For a different podcast I recently had to do for Black History Month here in the United States, I had to do an interview about Louis Armstrong's time in Chicago. And I'm like, how could I find that? And I'm like, wait a minute, I know Studs interviewed him. Yeah. And that's really all I needed was to kind of paraphrase that interview. And, you know, it's like at 2 or 3 in the morning after Louis Armstrong had just finished performing at Mr. Kelly's, which is was a famous local, especially jazz, but music venue. And Louis Armstrong's voice is hoarse and you can tell he's tired, but even Louis Armstrong's like, you know, can you hear me? Are you getting good sound? And, you know, you can imagine them just sitting in like the deserted club with people mopping in the background and just, you know, just like he was maybe talking to someone on the bus, which is another sort of famous way Chicagoans would interact with him, especially the North Side buses where he would come south from his home in Uptown.
It's hard to here in Chicago, anyway. I usually start any of my talks with, do you know Studs Terkel? And everybody wants to say, I used to see him on the bus. we used, you know, I ran into him here. One woman told me that he brought her mother soup. These are total strangers, but everybody has a Studs interaction, which speaks so well for him in my mind. He was so accessible, and partly what made him so very good at what he did.
Yeah, I suppose that accessibility it's almost like a, I don't want to say byproduct, but it's the other side of that. He wants, out of his own curiosity, the access to people, and part of that is making himself accessible, and it just becomes a way of living, right? Like it's
a way of living.
Yeah, you know, and that's why everybody has a story. That's why everybody's heard him on the radio. That's why everybody's read his book. It's like, because it's all just sort of parts of the same. Yeah, I'm resisting going back to your Rubik's Cube metaphor and using it in a different way, but it does feel a little bit like that. It's like all these parts are all turning, but they're all still part of the same thing. And that's some of the value of Studs Terkel, I guess. I guess that maybe is a nice place to turn here towards the end of our conversation and just ask what you guys think is important. Like, why does Studs Terkel, we've talked a lot about why he mattered across the very long life that his long life, which is also a very long working life. He pretty much worked right up to the last breath. And I guess I should say he died in I've just totally blanked on the year, 2008. This is maybe a story for another. I have a very strong memory of the moment that I learned that he died, because it was such a strange, it was in such a strange way. But
Can you tell us?
Well, yeah, I guess I can. So, because it was on Halloween that he died in 2008.
31st.
And I was at a concert here in London where I live, and the band Shellac, which is a Chicago band, were playing. They were headlining this concert, and they were all dressed in Halloween costumes. Mm-hmm. And they have a song called The End of Radio.
Oh my God.
And they played this song, and Steve Albini changed all of the lyrics of the song so that they were all about Studs Terkel. And I was standing in this crowd in London, and I thought, and he was dressed as the mummy. So he had like bandages all around him, and his glasses were over the top of these mummy wraps. And he's singing, it's more of a speaking thing, this song about that, every line was about Studs Terkel. And I just got really overwhelmed. I thought, oh my God, Studs Terkel must have died. Why else would he be doing this? And it was like, I was just standing there. I felt suddenly really far apart from the crowd, and felt really like strong emotional thing. It's like, this is something has ended here. And so it's not really about me. It's about this guy, you know, here's this band from Chicago in another country proclaiming this guy on a stage because he's just died, as a kind of honoring of his life. And this long working life of Studs Terkel resonates long beyond those years of his life. So I'm just asking the question finally now of like, what do you think he means beyond that working life? What do those resonances mean now in 2024 to each of you? Peter, why don't you start?
Sure. Anticipating this question a little bit, I'm always, I won't say surprised, but there has been in the 25 years, almost 25 years that I've been at the museum, there has been a constant stream of people interested in Studs' work. And I just made a list, you know, there's work in the local cabaret community around Studs. Of course, there's musicals, there's plays, there's many podcasts beyond this one, this fabulous podcast. There's an artist currently working on murals for Chicago bus stops and for one of the bus stops in the North Side neighborhood of Uptown where Studs lived. There, we did all kinds of conversations around the hat that he wore and his red socks and his tie. And a lot of that stuff we actually have in our costume collection at the museum. So people still know about him. And I think, you know, people won't always know about him, but teaching as I do in the public history program at our local DePaul University, and my students look at my title here at the museum, they know who Studs was. And maybe they know working, maybe they just have an amorphous understanding of who he was, but it still resonates with like the 20 to 22 year old set, at least here, you know, in Chicagoland. So there's that. The other thing I would say is it's from a historian's perspective, it's just fabulous primary historical material. You know, an example, and then I'll wrap up my comments. The most recent exhibition that I worked on at the Chicago History Museum was about Chicago's Polish communities. We have a huge Polish immigrant, Polish American, Polish refugee community here. I know there's a significant community in the UK as well, and in many other countries. Well, you know, what's one place to look for like great primary historical source material about Chicago's Polish communities is Studd's interviews. For one of his books, he interviewed very well-known United Steelworkers of America local leader and national leader Ed Sadlowski, who obviously was Polish American, but many other interviews as well. So, you know, you can't turn around on a topic here in Chicago history, especially, and not find some way that you can pull Studs in a useful way, not just in a, oh, let's pull Studs in because we always do.
Or almost like you were saying earlier, like you're talking about drawing on him as your resource for like, he's just a go-to resource to get yourself started to go and talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not even like drawing him in. It's
the final thing.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. Through our Studs Circle Center for Oral History, we do a lot of oral history training of people as young as like elementary school to senior citizens. And we always draw on that, you know, his simple, straightforward questioning, you know, and then what happened next? He called that the simplest question. And then what happened next? His importance lives on. It's not just a snapshot of the 50s to the early 2000s.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
That's great. Two things real quick. One is... it's fascinating to me that the musical working continues to be done constantly, almost 50 years, because it actually opened about 4 or 5 years after the book came out. So it's almost the same age. And high schools are doing it, colleges are doing it. I just saw a production at Northwestern. That kind of lives on. And when I was in New York, I did an event with Stephen Schwartz, who's the composer and lyricist who came up with the idea of doing that as a play and then pulled together other writers to do it. And I asked him, what prompted you, you know, what prompted you to do this? What was it in working that interested you so much? And he said he had seen just a little snippet, which was a telephone operator who said sometimes this is when they had real telephone operators. Sometimes, every once in a while, somebody says to me, "Hello, operator, how are you doing today? Are you having a good day today?" And then she said, "That just makes my day." And Stephen said, "Oh my God, that was not me. You know, I would just, if I was mad at Ma Bell, you know, the Monopoly, I would take it out on the operator." And he said, "What that book made me realize was I was seeing just their function, not the person. And that's a gift." And so that's why I am pleased that the play continues to be done. And I hope people look at that aspect of it. And then the other one is shorter. Someone said, and I think this is so true, he modeled engaging with the world through curiosity and conversation. He modeled that. And I hope we don't lose that. Because when you think of what conversation, at least what we see through the media is, it's not like what you're doing right now, Doug. You know, you're really asking questions. You're giving us time, right? And so I hold fast to that. He modeled that for us, and I hope that we can hang on to it.
I think that's a perfect note to finish on. I hope that people listening today are encouraged by that model, that Studs Circle model, to go out and listen to some of his work and find out what that model is and maybe read some of his books, listen to the stuff that's available on the Studs Circle archive. It's easy to find if you type Studs Circle into any search engine, it'll come straight up. Thank you very much to both of my guests, Mark Larson and Peter Alter. It's been a great conversation celebrating the work of Studs Terkel. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Doug. Well done.
Thank you. That was very enjoyable.
you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americanzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americanzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americanzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americanzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.